Welcome to the Native Advertising Powerhouse, a podcast dedicated to help publishers and native ad studio professionals build a solid framework for their native advertising efforts. The host of the show is Jesper Lawson, founder of the Native Advertising Institute.
My name is Jesper Lawson, and you're listening to the third episode of the Native Advertising Powerhouse. Today, we are welcoming Melanie Diesel. Melanie has been named one of 100 significant women in native advertising, and she will be speaking at our conference, Native Advertising Days in Berlin, this November. When people give presentations about native advertising throughout the world, there is one case that keeps popping up, even though it's several years old. I'm of course talking about the campaign Women Inmates at the New York Times, which was done for Netflix. Today's guest was actually the woman who invented this amazing award-winning piece when she was still at T-Brand Studio. Today, she is founder and CEO of Storyfuel and helping marketers tell equally amazing stories. Welcome on the show, Melanie.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
I thought you could maybe start out by sharing with us a little bit about your background and your experience with native advertising, because you've been, other than Storyfuel, your own company now, you've been with Time Inc. and T-Brand. So you've got a history with native advertising. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I've been around the branded content block a little bit, for sure. So I started out as a journalist. You know, that's what I studied. I always thought I would end up working in a newsroom, being a regular journalist. But I initially got hired by the Huffington Post for what is now HuffPost Partner Studio. We didn't have quite a name and a brand back then. But, you know, I was working as a content strategist there when I got out of graduate school. Really focused on helping advertisers understand how they could tell stories on Huffington Post in a way that was going to resonate with our readers. So we focused on lists and blog posts and slideshows and the kinds of things that our audience expected from us. Mm-hmm. Worked with a wide range of advertisers there. I ended up going over to the New York Times, where I helped found T-Brand Studio, as you mentioned. So I was the first editor of branded content there, you know, really helped kind of get things rolling. You know, there were only a few of us in the early days. We all wore a lot of hats and did a lot of different things, just trying to get things rolling, get everything set up, and get that team to a point where it could really operate almost like its own newsroom. And, you know, to the credit of all the folks at T-Brand, that's what they're doing today. You know, that team now has more than 100 people. You know, they're really, really moving. They're a well-oiled machine at this point. But I did, while I was there, I had the chance to work with so many talented creators, so many talented, you know, strategists. We worked on, you know, one of our famous pieces, the Women Inmates piece for Netflix and Orange is the New Black, which won a number of awards and kind of got us some wide recognition. After T-Brand Studio, I moved on to Time Inc., where I worked as director of creative strategy across all 35 of their U.S. magazines. So, you know, magazines and websites, that would be Time, Entertainment Weekly, People, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, you know, a lot of really big, really different brands.
Right.
And so, you know, that whole experience for me, I got to see what native looks like in a lot of different contexts, you know, through HuffPost, the, you know, where it's more of a lifestyle approach, through T-Brand Studio, where it was very hard news, very focused on educating and informing our readers. And then through Time Inc., where we were context switching all the time, you know, from a sports context to a financial context to an everyday news context. So that is sort of, that really broad experience is what inspired me to go out on my own and start my own consulting firm, where I could work directly with publishers who were looking to, you know, set up their own branded content practice, or with brands who were recognizing that, you know, these publishers have something figured out. They understand storytelling in a way that we don't. And maybe there are some things we could learn from the publishing side that we can incorporate into our marketing as a brand. So that's really where my focus has been for the last three or so years.
Mm. And so over these last years, you know, you've seen and you've worked with so many different types of native advertising. What is good native advertising to you?
It's a really good question. I think, you know, oftentimes when I'm working with brands and they're asking what does good content look like, it's coming from a place of maybe insecurity about their own content or just a desire to do content well. And most of the time, my response is, it depends. And, you know, that's not particularly helpful, I understand. But, you know, what's good is really so, so dependent on the context. You know, even if you think about in our everyday lives, you know, a good meal to your four-year-old is not the same as a good meal to your date when you're 17, or, you know, a good good meal now after a long week at work, you know?
Right.
So all these things, you know, the context is so important. So, you know, what's good, I think it has to do a few things. It has to acknowledge the context, you know, the actual environment and where it's being presented. Mm-hmm. It has to be audience centric, and that it has to recognize who the audience is in that environment and what they're looking for, what they expect. And it has to come from a place of true desire to serve. And, you know, I mean that in a content way, in that so many times people think that content is just sort of an excuse to sell something. And they think if we have a sales pitch, but we put a headline on it, that makes it content. And, you know, your readers will see right through that. So, you know, as long as it's aware of the context, it's aware of the audience, and it's acknowledging, you know, it really is, its purpose is to educate or entertain or otherwise to just serve and bring value to the audience. Mm-hmm. I think you're on your way to a good piece of content.
And do you think that's where native advertising has its strength? Is that in the top of the funnel, the awareness engagement, and lesser so, you know, generating leads or actual sales?
You know, I think some of the most informative or service oriented content does tend to be top of funnel, right? Because we're mm-hmm. focused on teaching the audience something. And for many news centric publishers, you know, many news magazines, news websites, that's really their sweet spot. That's the area where they're comfortable, because that's the role that brands are really allowed to play in their environment. They can be teachers. Mm. In those news-centric environments, a more product-focused message, editorial or otherwise, is much less common. And so it's much harder to have that kind of bottom of funnel, here's an in-depth product review type of content piece that's going to really drive sales.
Right.
Now, I think in a magazine or a lifestyle or a very specific niche publication, you can definitely be much more bottom funnel. You know, I give the example, when you pick up a women's lifestyle magazine, a beauty magazine, a fashion magazine,
right.
your express purpose is to be shown products, to be given reviews, and to be told what to wear, what to buy, and how to do it.
Yeah.
So in that environment, a brand has a much bigger role, even editorially. So it makes sense for us to see, you know, more brand provided content about how to use the products, or, you know, questions we might have about products. It's much more natural for a brand to have a role in those types of lifestyle mm-hmm. or niche environments. So I think it really depends. It's much easier, as I said, to be bottom of funnel when you're in that environment where a product message is more tolerated. I think that product focused message can be much more difficult to do in an organic way if you're in a news centric environment, you know, from a content perspective, where
right.
those kinds of messages don't always fit.
But I guess it's really, again, about being, you know, audience focused and saying, putting it into a context where it doesn't feel like an alien element.
Right. Yeah, it's a matter of finding out where the brand fits. What role can the brand play here?
Mm.
And, you know, I think, as I mentioned, like a teacher is one. It's very easy. You know, brands have expertise in certain areas that we as consumers and oftentimes those of us who are, you know, journalists or creators, we don't have that expertise. We haven't been inside the factory, or we haven't made that specific product. We haven't learned how to fix it. And so, you know, brands can offer a ton of value by sharing that expertise and that knowledge with our readers and with us.
Mm.
I think, you know, being a teacher is one of the easiest ways for a brand to add value to almost any environment.
Right. And throughout the years you've been working with native advertising, is there a piece you're particularly proud of? I mean, you mentioned the Women Inmate. That's a very famous case. Is that the one, mm-hmm. your beacon?
I think it would be hard for me to pick another one, just given the way other people have reacted to that piece. You know, for anyone who may not be familiar, this is a piece we did in the summer of 2014, actually. You know, hard to believe that it's stayed important and resonant this long. But it was for Orange is the New Black. And basically what we did at T-Brand Studio at the time was sort of an in-depth long-form piece explaining what it's really like to be a woman in prison. So we talked to current and former inmates, to people who work inside the prison. We went inside for a three-part mini documentary to interview these women, looked at government data to create infographics. It was really, you know, a piece of brand journalism, really in depth, looking at what it's really like to be a woman in prison, not from the standpoint of a character on the show, but from real women. And, you know, that piece, as we said, you know, it was kind of widely hailed as a great example of journalistic style native advertising. You know, we won a number of awards from Digiday and, you know, an OMA award. And the piece performed in the top 2% of all content published on the New York Times that year. So, you know, our readers, our industry, everyone was telling us that really was a great piece. And for me, as someone who comes from the journalism side, being able to talk about an important issue, about something that could actually affect change, mm-hmm. you know, it fed that part of my soul. That, you know, that's why I got into storytelling in the first place and got into journalism in the first place, was a desire to tell stories that matter. So for me, you know, that part is particularly lovely. What I would say is that there's actually another piece also from my time at T Brand that I'm also really proud of that hasn't gotten anywhere near as much play. But we did a piece with Cole Haan, the shoe company. They had a number of New York City ballerinas who were in their ad campaigns, you know, appearing in photos and whatnot, wearing different items from the Cole Haan collections. And so we did something very similar there. We took a look, we sort of embedded with these ballerinas over the period of a few weeks, filming them, going to practices, et cetera, interviewing them to see what it's really like to be a ballerina. What does it take? You know, what do their bodies go through? What do they go through mentally? What does it take to hit a point where, you know, you can perform at that level, and what does that do to your body? Sort of this balance of, you know, how much effort and pain and struggle it takes to do something that looks so light and effortless and beautiful.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, my master's degree is actually in arts and cultural criticism. So, you know, I love the arts, I love ballet. And so to be able to, you know, embed in that world, you know, certainly in contrast to the Netflix piece, a much lighter world, it was, you know, different topic that was a little easier to deal with day in and day out, certainly, than something so serious. But just to be able to embed with the arts that way and tell a story that was a little more about the art and the voice and, you know, the style of writing than necessarily digging into a ton of facts and presenting, you know, something that was otherwise a little less palatable. You know, that contrast, I think, of something very hard news and then something very arts focused, you know, those two pieces are certainly up there.
And I think they're actually technically still up there, right? So people can actually go see them. And I do a lot of speaking on native advertising, and I actually use especially the women inmates as one of the, you know, the premier example of native advertising. Some of the videos that you did, I mean, I must have watched it like 70 times, and it keeps choking me up once I see, you know, these women talking about the downsides, obviously, of being in prison. I mean, it's really powerful stuff. So
it really is.
I urge anybody to go find it and check it out.
Yeah, and I would say if you're looking for it, you can search anytime you're looking for this. New York Times paid post, and then the name of whatever the sponsoring brand is. So in this case, New York Times paid post Netflix, New York Times paid post Cole Haan. I'm sure that will come up for you. They're all fairly searchable.
And could you, maybe with the women inmates or the other one, could you share with us a little bit about, you know, how this came to life? Like, what was the process or the story behind the project?
Yeah, you know, in both of these cases, luckily, they follow a very similar format. And that format is consistent with the process that we followed on most of our pieces there. And I think this is true probably across the industry. But generally, what happens is, you know, at the content studio on the publisher side, you get an RFP, a request for proposal, and it's usually coming from the brand directly or from an agency on their behalf saying, basically, here's what we want. You know, this is their custom order. This is them saying, we want something that goes live during this time period for this amount of money that accomplishes these goals, you know, and here's how we're going to know it's successful, and, you know, any additional context they might be able to share.
Right.
Now, they will have sent that RFP to, as we understand it, you know, 10, 15, 20, 50 other publishers asking us all to propose something in response. So, you know, usually at that phase of the process, depending on how big your team is, you might be just coming up with, you know, a couple paragraphs of what you might put together. You might be building a full scale, you know, visual mock-up of what this proposed experience would look like. You know, you're having brainstorms with your team. You know, you're just trying to give them enough information to see, like, yes, our idea, the thing we propose building for this project is really cool and you're going to love it and you should definitely buy it from us. So those proposals all go back to the brand or their agency. They sort through all the ideas and then hopefully they come back to you and say, yes, we would like to buy that, please. And they give you some money so you can get to building. So that's what happened in both the Cole Haan piece and the Netflix piece, was RFP responsive. And, you know, we put together a good enough pitch that they wanted to work together with us. You know, and then what happens is over the course of, I would say, anywhere from 5 to 10 or 12 weeks, you know, depending on the scale of the project, you know, you're in this sort of delicate dance back and forth with the brand and their agency where you're building something, you're sharing a snippet, you're getting approvals, you're getting feedback, you're building more, you're iterating on it. So it is this sort of collaborative process where you're building and you're sharing and you're building and you're sharing toward the goal of getting that piece to a point where you can publish it on the desired published date. You know, there's always with every brand, there's a different amount of involvement. There's a different amount of them weighing in and, you know, wanting to show the role that they played in that content, right? Different brands have different desires for how present they are and how they exert and show their brand and their content. But in the case of both Cole Haan and in the case of, you know, Netflix and Orange Is the New Black in this case, they really respected the storytelling and they really wanted to let the story unfold naturally. They didn't want to shoehorn and force the brand anywhere into the content where it didn't belong. And that made them absolutely wonderful partners to work with because they truly respected the story itself. They wanted, you know, in service of the audience, they wanted the content to be as good as possible,
right,
even if that meant the branding level might be slightly less than what they expected. You know, they really let the story determine how that unfolded and not, you know, sort of forcing a brand presence in a specific kind of way on the content in a way that would negatively impact it. So it was wonderful partners to work with for sure.
I think you're probably touching on one of the toughest situations that a lot of publishers are facing because, you know, first they need to educate the brands in what is native advertising and why do you need to tell good stories. Mm-hmm. And then even if they succeed to some extent, you know, educating the brands, I know a lot of publishers that still end up with brands that want to control the story or they want to, you know, infuse the brand in every other line of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Or what would your advice be to those kind of publishers that are facing those kinds of pushbacks from brands?
Yeah, I mean, this is undoubtedly, it's a really hard question. I mean, you, in a sales context, you have to acknowledge the fact that, like, you know, these are your clients, these are your customers. And on some level, especially if you're beholden to a sales goal, you do have to keep them happy. You know, you don't want them to pull the business or not renew or whatever that is. And I can totally respect the pressure that creates for a sales team or a marketing team. But I do think that it is our responsibility as publishers, as content studios, as storytellers, to really be honest with our brands when we're working together about what their decisions will do to their content. And I have found if I take that approach, like, it is my responsibility to guide this brand in the world of storytelling and to protect them from the things that they don't know will hurt them and be as honest as possible, I've found that they generally appreciate it. And at least if they ignore my warnings, then when we get to a point where the promise inevitably comes true, then, you know, I sort of, my hands are clean. I've tried my best to protect you. But now, you know, you've decided to move forward anyway.
I told you so.
Yeah, you know, and you never want to go that route either. But, you know, the way I would always phrase it is, you know, if you get a question like, hey, can we put 6 more logos on the page? You know, you come back and you say, I totally understand. It sounds like you really want to make sure our, you know, like sort of reflect back to them. It sounds like you want to make sure that our readers know that the content is coming from you. And I totally understand that. My concern is this, you know, so you're sharing, this is my concern. Mm-hmm. And you say, in the past, when we've seen a lot of logos on a page, it's negatively impacted performance. And I know that you told me that, you know, such and such KPI is very important to you. So my concern is, again, that if we put those logos, that you will not achieve your goal. Is that still something you'd like to do? We can do it for you, but my recommendation would be no. So you fully laid out, like, I understand what your concern is. I know what you're asking us to do. Historically, this causes it to perform poorly. I recommend against it. Would you still like us to do it? So you've laid it out as clearly as possible. You know, you're not being unkind, you're not sort of pushing them into anything, but you're being very honest about the fact that, like, yes, what you've asked of me is possible. However, it goes against our best practices, it goes against my recommendations, and it's up to you. Would you still like to do it?
Yeah.
And I have found that generally when you're being that honest, and when it's genuinely coming from a place of, like, I understand why you want this. Here's why it's not good for you. You know, oftentimes it really helps them see it differently. I don't think that brands wake up in the morning and think, gee, how could I ruin this content I've paid so much for? You know, that's not what they're thinking.
Hopefully not.
They just, the instincts are different. Just like our instincts, you know, as storytellers or creatives, we're clued into content. We might not have the same instincts when it comes to programmatic or, you know, design on a page. It's not our skill set necessarily. So I feel like we do have to sort of, it's almost like a role that we have to play. We're sort of the guardians of storytelling. You do have to be honest and say, I understand your intent, but the actions you want us to take are not going to give you the desired results. You know, just kind of helping them understand that the storytelling world is a little bit different than what they may have seen in banner ads or TV ads or something else.
I've actually met with publishers who did two separate campaigns, or, you know, they did the version that the brand wanted, and then they did, you know, an extra one the way they wanted it. And luckily, you know, as it is in digital, they were able to show the differences in performances in the way that they wanted to do it and the way the brand insisted on it. Of course, that's a that's a delicate route, you know, to go down, but it could provide you with some sort of a little more hard evidence in terms of that.
That's a challenge too. Yeah, of course, if you do start making those claims about what works and what doesn't, you will have to back it up in some way. So do be careful and be prepared to do that.
Mm. So you mentioned that one of the ways to create at least pitches is to respond to an RFP. Another way that some publishers are doing it is by, you know, starting out with either a brand or an industry that they're, you know, they want to cater to, and then come up with creative ideas and then go sell those ideas. So it might be, you know, you come up with something for a bank and then you go to your best, you know, financial client and you say, listen, this is something that would really fit our audience. And we need, you know, a bank to support that. Mm-hmm. Is that something for you? Is that, have you worked that way around, or has it, you know, mainly been, you know, responding to RFPs?
I think, you know, occasionally we would call that sort of proactive, right? Where you've got your idea and then you go out and try to sell it. I have seen some proactive pitches come to life. I think, broadly speaking, when you get an RFP, what you know is the brand is willing to create content and they have budget to create content. Mm. And I have found that, you know, when you're doing proactive pitching, you don't always have that guarantee. So you may have the best banking idea in the world, but if Wells Fargo and Santander and Chase and all these others, if they've already spent for the year or for the quarter, you're not going to be able to find that sponsor to really, you know, back it up. So what I have found is sort of a combination where you may have your best banking idea and you hold that and you wait until you get an RFP from a banking client, and you know we've already got built and ready to go the best possible banking idea we could. And we've done the same thing for auto, for, you know, you don't want it to be too generic, of course. You know, you want the brand to feel that it's special, so you can adapt it in ways that make sure it fits their RFP. But, you know, by doing that proactive brainstorming, you have sort of a bank of your best ideas ready to go, so that when an opportunity comes up, you're not scrambling to come up with a banking idea. Maybe you have three great banking ideas already ready and waiting.
Right.
And I think, to your point, this is particularly helpful if you get pitches from the same kind of brands very often, or the same categories very often. You know, it's a creative challenge, to say the least, to have to come up with a retirement themed content idea that's truly unique, you know, five times a month for a whole year.
Yeah.
You know, so having that brain space with your team to really do those brainstorms, come up with proactive ideas that would fit a number of different topics or categories like that, you know, do your best, know when you do your best work. And if you're doing your best brainstorms when you're not under the pressure of an RFP, then making time to have that ready to go, you can kind of combine that approach of when a proactive opportunity comes up, we've got it. And when the RFPs come in, we've got stuff ready to go.
I met with a publisher 2 weeks back, and they were really struggling because a lot of agencies, media agencies, would come to them and say, you know, do you have any idea for such and such? And then they would go ahead and come up with some creative ideas, some conceptual pieces. And then the agency would take that to the client, and then either they'd never hear back, or they wouldn't get it, or they'd actually even experienced that some of their ideas came to life outside of their own platforms. Now, that was, I think they told me that around 1 in 10 of the ideas that they came up with for agencies actually was something that they end up selling. And it is a hugely expensive exercise for them to keep coming up with those ideas. And they were really struggling. They were even thinking about, you know, not working with agencies or anything. Do you have any, you know, any ideas or suggestions for publishers that are in that situation?
I wish that I could really help solve this problem, because I do think it faces a lot of publishers. I mean, I can think of one time where I had been working with a brand and their agency, and they had us going running around in circles for, you know, the better part of 3 or 4 months, just iterating on an idea and adapting and making new mockups and editing and adapting and making new mockups again. And they ultimately didn't buy it from us. They didn't do anything. So it was, you know, hundreds of man hours spread across our team over the course of several months that resulted in no new business. And it's such a frustrating process. I think from a creative perspective, especially, you know, to put all your effort into building an idea or coming up with a concept or a tagline or, you know, some sort of program idea, content idea, and then to see it come to life by someone else's hands can be incredibly frustrating. So I wish I could solve this problem. I think, unfortunately, in the current environment, the way our industry works right now, you know, coming up with ideas is the equivalent of filling out a job application for these campaigns. And if you want to get the job, you've got to fill out the application, at least the way the market works right now. You know, I mean, the proactive business is good, but even still, if you're going out there pitching your ideas to people who haven't asked, you still run that same risk of them saying, that is a great idea, we'll do that. You know, the one thing I have tried to impress upon the publishers and the content studios I work with is one way you can try to combat this is to make your ideas so unique to your platform that it can't live elsewhere.
Right.
So whether that is you have a certain kind of technology or a certain talent, right? The only people who could do it in this way or with this perspective. You know, you've got a writer who has, you know, certain experience that someone else doesn't, or, you know, data that no one else has in order to make that infographic. I mean, you've got to find a way to make it so that it only works on your platform.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that uniqueness that, you know, it's a little bit like a recipe. You know, anybody can make a grilled cheese sandwich, right? I mean, it's cheese and bread and butter, right? Mm. But if your recipe at your restaurant has some little secret special something, people continue to come to you for your, you know, truffle lobster grilled cheese with something else, you know, because it's so special to you that they can't actually do it on their own. Conceptually, they like it, but they couldn't accomplish that on their own at home. So your idea needs to be that. If you're out there pitching regular grilled cheeses, everybody's going to make it at home. If you've got that special secret ingredient that's unique to you that, you know, can only be done by you in your way, then you kind of can help to some degree protect people, you know, protect the fact that people will keep coming to you. And at the end of the day, if there's truly someone out there who's going out there maliciously requesting, you know, sending out RFPs solely to steal others' intellectual property, I mean, if you can identify some of those people and stop working with those specific people or those specific agencies, I mean, that I certainly would back you up on that plan. I just think, unfortunately, the environment right now requires us to kind of give our ideas away for free in hopes of gaining some business. So our best defense is really unique ideas.
I think another, staying on that subject, I think another issue sometimes is that if it's a media agency that are, you know, not necessarily native advertising experts, so even if they want to, they're having a hard time pitching the idea to their clients just for the sole, you know, the problem that they don't necessarily really get native. As a publisher, you might consider, you know, insisting on being part of the pitch to the client. So say, okay, I can come up with three ideas, but I want to be in on when you present that to the client. So you're sure that A, the client knows that it's your idea, and B, that the idea is actually being told in the right way.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly an option. I have not had as much luck with that. I find that the agencies, especially the ones who are doing sort of the sketchy thing, you know, collecting everyone else's ideas,
right,
they don't tend to like let you behind the curtain to see what they're up to. But yeah, I mean, anytime you have a chance to be a part of a media day or to go and directly pitch your ideas on your own, you definitely have the best chance of making sure it's being well represented, that it's being well pitched, and that, you know, your ideas are coming to life for the brand in the way that you hoped they would.
You mentioned before a little bit about the process of coming up with creative ideas in terms of the Cole Haan and the Netflix piece. Could we take a little bit of a deep dive into the process of coming up with concepts? Not necessarily not the selling of the idea, but like what would happen? So you get an RFP. Could you take us through that process? What would that look like?
Yeah, definitely. And I think this process looks a little bit different at every publisher because it depends on the content studio and its makeup, right? You know, there are some studios that have so much talent, you know, that are, they're separated out by roles, and you have people whose whole job it is just to come up with the concepts. And there are other content studios that maybe are a little bit smaller, or, you know, are working with different efficiencies, and, you know, the role of brainstorming falls on the designers or the editors or whoever else. So, I think generally speaking, what you do is you end up with whoever those people are who are making the ideas. You have them hopefully get in a room and talk together. And you want to really take a look at the RFP. You want to see, you know, what's the key objective of the brand? What's the brand trying to accomplish? You want to take some time to think about things like the budget and the timing, like what's actually realistic to accomplish in this time period. Because, you know, one great way to lose business is to pitch something that, you know, doesn't fit the budget or can't reasonably be accomplished in the time span that, you know, you have to complete it. You know, you want to just kind of ask those really important questions to make sure what you're coming up with is extremely realistic given the budget, given the timing, given the goal of the brand, right? Because again, if the brand is asking you to raise awareness about something and you're pitching them a conversion or a sales focused idea, then, you know, you're going to miss the mark. So, I mean, all of those things are part of that conversation. I think the other thing you want to have, at least have some sort of role in that conversation, is people with different perspectives. So if you can have someone from your design team, someone from your video team, someone from editorial, someone from development, you know, building the pages. I mean, all of that, all of those different perspectives, people are going to have different ideas. They're going to have different inspiration. They're going to have different takes or different, you know, ways of approaching the same kind of content or same question. And I think the more diverse perspectives you can have in the room, you know, the better off it'll end up being. I think the key thing, and this is something we used to do at the Times, is decide which of those departments or categories is going to be the lead on any specific project. Because what you don't want is just sort of an endless brainstorm that never ends up anywhere. You know, just sort of a million ideas thrown out and no decisions made. So, you know, having someone to lead the brainstorm, even if that's just the de facto person for the purpose of the brainstorm and not for the full project, having someone to lead that conversation, you know, make sure the right perspectives are brought in, you know, and sort of moderate that conversation can be really, really helpful for balancing all those different needs and all those different perspectives during the brainstorm process.
Right. So you mentioned bringing in a lot of different different perspectives, a lot of different people. You've helped create studios. Came to the T-Brand Studios, where a studio when it was really small. If you were to start a studio from scratch, because, and that's what a lot of publishers are facing at the moment, either starting from scratch or they have one or two people or so. But if you were to start a studio from scratch, how would you organize it? What would you be your, like, your first hires?
Yeah. So my answer here, as it often is it depends.
That's a good one.
I know it really is. It's applicable in so many situations. I think, you know, I don't want to give one blanket answer because I think a studio needs to be custom fit for the organization where it lives. And so the first thing I would do before I would make any hires or write any job descriptions is I would look at what works editorially. What departments do we have on the editorial side? What are the formats that we create, right? Do we have a lot of photographers or a lot of videographers, a lot of designers? Maybe it's all writers and we have no visuals whatsoever. The information that you get from your editorial organization is really key for structuring something on the native side, right, that's going to work and complement that well. Because if you are at an organization that is incredibly visual and you only run photo slideshows and videos, and then you go and hire the best editor out there who's going to write the best stories, you're going to end up with content that doesn't fit your environment, no matter how good it is. That's not what your readers come for. It's not what they expect. So you really got to start on the edit side. So the first thing I would do is see, again, what departments do we have and what formats do we have on the editorial side, because that's our indication about what our readers expect and what our readers want. And then what we want to do is try to replicate that on the editor or on our branded content side. So, for example, if I found that, you know, we have mostly written content being created by editors, then I would probably start by hiring an editor and say, I want someone to come in here, have an amazing grasp of the written word and an understanding of what makes good stories. And I'm hiring an editor and not just a writer, because I would like that person down the line to be able to take on the role of leading younger writers or freelancers or, you know, new hires down the road. So, you know, especially in those early days, you want to have an eye for someone who is going to be able to grow into the future of your content team. So someone who has management potential, perhaps some management experience, or someone who can just take that next step. You don't want to hire, you know, a a freelance writer who has no management experience, who's never worked on a team, and expect that that person in a year or two will be able to be your editorial director without any experience. Now, there may be exceptions. There are some wonderfully talented people who maybe just haven't gotten that chance. But by and large, if I'm starting out, I would be looking for someone who's going to be able to grow into that leadership role and take their experience to the next level when we have to expand our team. So the same would be true if you're hiring, you know, you find that you have a lot of video on your edit side and you probably want to have, you know, a video director on your, you know, on your brand side as well. Mm-hmm. And again, that should be someone who could be capable of leading what might become a video team in the future. Same thing for photo or design, you know, any of these other departments that you find necessary, development, you know, anything that becomes important for you. I think those are going to be key. The other thing sort of outside of content creation that you want to think about, someone is going to have to manage the back and forth between your content team and the clients. Mm-hmm. And that same person might serve as a mediator between your content team and the sales team. So whether you call these people project managers or campaign managers or client specialists, someone should be in charge of, you know, sort of translating between all these teams, managing timelines and overseeing the projects to make sure things get done on time. And, you know, that's a role that is often forgotten until you realize that that role is very hard to do while you're doing any of the other roles in the team. So you want someone dedicated to sort of keep things running smoothly. Mm. And the next thing you might want that's sort of, again, not directly tied to content production would be something in social media or distribution. So, you know, how you use social media is going to depend largely, again, on it depends how your editorial team is using social media. If it's important for them, it will likely be important for you. Mm. And if you are not able to share the social resources from the editorial side, you know, if you can't use those same accounts or the same people to publish posts and buy, you know, social ads for content, then you will probably want someone on your side to be able to take up that torch and, you know, be buying Facebook ads or using Outbrain traffic or whatever it is that you need from a social perspective and from a traffic perspective to make sure that your brand content performs well.
So the first thing is kind of creating a mirror of the editorial side of your business, you know, depending on what kind of publication or media you're running. And
right.
And then adding the distribution person or the social media person, and then the project manager.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of competencies does that person need to have? I mean, you are, as a studio, you are acting as an agency as well, right? Which is a
right.
completely different ballgame from, you know, if you come from the editorial world, you're not used mm-hmm. to servicing brands in the way that an agency is.
Right.
Isn't that something that you need to take into account and get on your team?
Definitely. I would say that, you know, most of the creative roles that you'd be taking, you know, whether it's an editorial director, an editor, a strategist, you know, a video producer, photographer, many of those folks are likely coming from an editorial background, or they could be well suited to your position if they're coming from an editorial background. Mm. However, when it does come to like a project manager or a client manager, it is much more important that that person have client management experience. And they're most likely, more than any other role on your team, to be coming from that agency world, because that's where they're going to have that excellent experience in doing things like that, right? Like you said, in managing a client, in managing timelines, you know, in keeping a group moving toward a common goal.
Mm.
These roles do tend to be more entry level, I would say, but you know that it's quite possible to find an amazingly organized recent grad with a communications degree who, you know, just by virtue of their personality happens to be incredibly organized and, you know, respectful enough to have those kind of client conversations. They just have an intuition for it. I've seen a lot of really successful client managers and project managers come through that way, but there is something to be said for, you know, trained and, you know, tested sort of client managers coming from more of the agency side. They just have a much deeper understanding of what the brand concerns might be, what the different things at play that you might not know if you're coming from the editorial side.
Mm. So we talked a little bit about selling, you know, the whole mm-hmm. pitching thing. But one of the biggest questions, you know, that for in terms of native advertising that publishers are struggling with is how to sell native advertising. And what role do you see the creatives playing in that process? Should they be part of that, or how do you see that?
Yeah, I think creatives can play a really important role in the sales process, but I do think it's one that needs to be carefully chosen and calculated in a way that doesn't drain from what their actual day jobs are, right? Because
okay.
ultimately you hire the creatives to do their creative work, And if those folks are spending all day in client pitches, they're not going to be able to produce the kinds of things you hired them to produce. So, you know, you do want to have a balance there, but I think it's, there's something to be said for having the person or the people who came up with these ideas in the room explaining it to the client. The kind of passion that comes through when you're talking about your craft and the thing that you love and the thing that you create is really hard to replicate if it's not your thing. And so there's a lot of value in, for a brief moment or for a short, you know, presentation, bringing in the creative team to say, here's what we want to create. Here's why we feel strongly about this idea. You know, that passion just tends to really come through.
And do you have any, I mean, you've helped sell native app projects. So could you give, you know, some of your best advice for that process?
So, I mean, I think this process can go so many ways and there's so many different ways to sell. Like we even talked about just the difference between proactive, where you're bringing the ideas to the client, and then the RFP responsive. I think, you know, some of the things I would do, number one, again, finding a strategic way to bring in a creative or editorial or someone who's not part of the sales team to give a content perspective can have a lot of value. The other thing that I think is very important is to manage expectations and talk about KPIs during that pitch process, because again, we're asking brands to speak the language of content, which is not their first language. And so it's important for us to make sure they really understand the terms that we're using and how we measure success. So I found that incredibly valuable to say, you know, this is what we think successful content looks like. Do you agree with that? You know, is that what you're going for? Because you can almost use that sales process as a way to identify sometimes if people are not the right partner too. You know, you don't want to work with people who you won't be able to please because they're looking for something that you can't accomplish, you know, or they're looking for something very different. So, you know, level setting on the terms and the KPIs is an important part of that process too. And I think, you know, I have found that visuals just tend to work really well. And that doesn't mean that you have to mock up exactly what your proposed experience would look like. That's a very resource intensive process, and it's not always feasible to do a custom mock-up for every pitch. But sometimes, you know, there's even a lot of value in showing an example of an editorial piece that takes a similar form, just so they can see, this is what it's going to be shaped like. This is how it will move. This is what this will, how you'll interact with this piece, just to show what it looks like. And even if you're saying, you know, this will say this instead, this picture will be of this instead, just to have something visual for them to look at, you know, tends to make it much more concrete. You know, we think in content, but not everyone does. And so having a tangible thing to point to, whether it's a static visual you've created or a live piece that you're sort of explaining and adapting, can make a really big difference in helping them understand.
Can't that be kind of a dangerous route to go down? I mean, sometimes if you let people think for themselves, you know, they can visualize something. And if you show them something, they could be like, ah, this is not what I envisioned. You know, this is off. So can't that be dangerous at the same time if you're not doing the real one?
Sure. I mean, there's always that risk though, regardless of what kind of visual you create, you know? And I think in my experience, showing something is often better than showing nothing. And I think it's very easy to pivot if someone says, you know, you're showing them an example and they say, oh, I don't like the green. And you say, no problem. The colors are going to be totally custom. I just wanted you to see what an interactive map looks like. And they're like, oh, okay, I get it. In that case, it can be purple. You know, they understand that, you know, it's not that. Hopefully you can pivot. And I mean, if you have a very particular client, you know, you always know your client's best, or your sales team will know the client best.
Yeah.
And if they are going to react poorly to something like that, then, you know, you make that judgment call in the moment.
Yeah. And I guess it shows some commitment that you're actually willing to go an extra mile to get that job.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I was talking the other day to Farrah Warner, who has a background. She was running the branded studio at Dow Jones. Mm-hmm. She has worked at Newsweek and AOL. And we talked about using editorial staff to actually create native. Now, just a minute ago, you mentioned that you could bring in editorial people for the ideation process. I know there's a different types of publications. The New York Times might not want to do that. I mean, using editorial staff, but at the same time, we do some research every year, both on the magazine industry and the news industry, and a lot of publishers in both industries are actually using their editorial staff to create native. you know, how do you see that? Is that a good idea?
Yeah, I suppose I should have specified. I meant more so the editorial members of your content studio. So whoever okay. those brand editors are, that, you know, someone like what I was at T Brand Studio, you know, I was an editor of branded content, and I would come in as a non-salesperson to, you know, give the editorial content perspective in those meetings. But, you know, to be clear, we never would have members of the actual newsroom editorial staff as part of that sales process. That was just
okay.
definitely not something we would be doing. And being candid, you know, I've, of course, you know, as a member of the board, I've seen the surveys we do every year. It always surprises me how many respond that they are using their actual newsroom editorial staff to create brand content. It's not something I've seen happen, truthfully, not in the US. And it's something that I also think most of the editorial folks that I know would take issue with, because they would probably feel like it crosses a line of objectivity. Now, granted, there are some exceptions. Again, I think if you're at a news-focused publication, then the idea of your energy reporter doing sponsored content for Shell or BP, you know, that's crossing a line, right?
Right.
If you're a, you know, you happen to be the dedicated shoes reporter for, you know, a fashion magazine, and you happen to be, you know, you kind of expect that person is getting free products, you know, has favorite brands already. It's maybe a little less offensive for you as a reader for them to be a part of like a recommendation from a, you know, a paid recommendation from a brand or something. So, I mean, I think, again, it depends on your editorial stance and how protected those editors are from brands as a general rule. Very much like the idea of keeping the creation of branded content and editorial content separate inside of a publisher, mm. and especially at a news-centric publisher where trust is really the only thing keeping you in business with your readers.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see how maybe because they're desperate in terms of meeting their budgets, but how many publishers are actually willing to risk that that trust that they've built over, you know, decades or even centuries. One of our studies show that a scary amount of publishers are not putting any label at all on their native advertising. It's like 10-11%, depending on which industry. And I'm always amazed by the fact that they're willing to jeopardize, you know, probably the most valuable thing they have.
Yeah, it is really tough. And it's just one of those areas that I think people have really strong opinions either way. And for me, like I'm very firm that, you know, being desperate for revenue, even still, I mean, if you lose that trust, I mean, what do you have left? I mean, if your readers don't trust anything you say, even editorially, I mean, there goes subscriptions, there goes your ad revenue because you lost traffic. So it is just such a careful act and such a fine line. I always recommend keeping it separate, even if you've got to hire freelancers, right? You don't have to take on a huge expense to have this content created. You can pay an outside freelancer and not have to take that, you know, not have to take on a full-time employee from a financial risk perspective and not have to jeopardize the trust either.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, there's probably a difference between how the New York Times would act and how a magazine publisher would act. I mean, to some of the big news corporations, obviously, this could be a bigger issue than to some magazines. Not to say that they could avoid labeling or, you know, but they might be able to pull it off easier than the New York Times could.
Yeah, again, you know, that's where the it depends comes in, right? Every brand has every publisher has their own standards, their own concerns, and their own priorities. So it's definitely it's different for everyone. You have to trust your gut on what makes sense for you.
And what do you see if we look into the crystal ball? Like, what do you see happening in the next 12 months in native advertising?
You know, this is always my least favorite question because I think it's the hardest it's the hardest to answer well, right? Because
that's why I gave it to you at the end.
it's just the hardest to answer well because I think truthfully we don't really know. You know, I mean, it's really hard to predict how things will change. I mean, we have some indication. I think broadly speaking, we know that native is continuing to grow. So, you know, we can be hopeful that there's continued revenue on the horizon, that those publishers and those brands who are investing in native advertising are going to continue to do so, and that new brands and new publishers will continue to join the ranks. So that's good news for anyone building a team or building a practice. I think overall, we've seen folks starting to realize the value in slightly less branded storytelling. So we're seeing, you know, more service oriented content. I think in the early days of content, you know, a few years ago, it was much more of a sales pitch with a headline, and more so in the last, you know, few years, few months, and increasingly there's less branded stories that are more focused on reader and value and service to your audience. So that is, it's heartening for me as a former journalist. But other than that, I mean, it's really hard for me to feel sure of oncoming trends. I mean, I know that I'm excited to see the way new formats and new platforms challenge us to think about what's native in these new contexts. You know, things like AR and VR, 360, you know, over the last, you know, year or two has kind of forced us to think a little bit differently about what a native integration of a brand is in all these different environments. And I think from a creative perspective, that's really exciting. I like being challenged to think of how a brand belongs in different environments. So I hope that some exciting new platforms come along and force us to think that way too.
Yeah, I remember you when we were speaking at the Native Advertising Days, our conference in Berlin, you said something that I really liked. You said that we got to remember that native is an adjective. So it could be native in, you know, basically many different shapes and forms and environments.
Yeah.
And so when there a new platform arises, and so, you know, it could be put in there. So I thought that was a very good point.
Yeah. I mean, I think for those of us who work in the publishing world, you know, whether we're at a magazine, a newspaper, a website, native for us means content, right? Native, what is native in our environment is other content, other videos, other articles, et cetera. But it is important to remember that, like you said, native is an adjective, and, you know, native means something that is organic, that belongs, that fits in its surroundings. And so for me, I love thinking about, well, what's a brand's native role in a restaurant environment? What's a brand's native role in a music video or a film or, you know, anything else? I mean, there's so many places in this world that we interact with brands. You know, when you think of in a taxi, in an airport, you know, what are the different ways that brands can natively fit and can actually add value to an experience instead of being disruptive? And that for me, you know, from a creative standpoint, it really is just such a cool challenge to think that way and try to think instead of, you know, what are the regular ad formats that we can use, but instead, what are the ways a brand could fit in and add value here? So, I mean, I think if we expand our definition of what native means and start looking at the world through that lens, we're going to come up with a lot cooler concepts to bring to life.
But it kind of touches on an interesting point, though, in terms of how native should native be, right? There are, you know, different definitions, true native or, you know, and to, you know, if you take it to, you know, all the way, it should be native to that, you know, that publication only. So if you create a piece for that magazine or that newspaper or something, it doesn't fit in, you know, the guy next door. But on the other hand, that kind of creates a scalability problem, doesn't it? Because if you know, it's hard, it's expensive to create good native. So sometimes the brand would be, you know, eager to use it on different types of platforms, be it Facebook or you know, beside the publisher's platforms. Well, what are your thoughts on that? Like, how native should native be?
I mean, if you want it to succeed, then it needs to be native enough to belong in the environment where it's being promoted. But that being said, I mean, if you think about even editorial content, newsroom content, there's a lot of content that's published in Entrepreneur magazine that could also live on Inc. or Forbes, or honestly, even the Wall Street Journal or Business Insider, right? You know, there is some overlap in the things that we cover. It's usually just a slightly different perspective or using different technology or different talent. And so, you know, a lot of the raw assets that you create in the process of creating content for one platform can be repurposed and reused in another. It's not unusual for content to live on a publisher platform and then find a second life on the blog of that sponsoring brand after it's come down or after its promotion has ended, and to be promoted on Facebook, promoted on Twitter, promoted on other social platforms, to, you know, have the video run at a booth, at an event. You know, there's a lot of ways to repurpose content the same way we do on the editorial side. You know, the content rarely has just one purpose or one life, you know, even to the point of when you take a photo at an event, it gets added to the archives for future references to that person or place. So, you know, there's a lot of ways you can kind of make use of content and add more scale to it, more ROI to, you know, your individual investment. I think what I don't want is for people to think that content can be as transportable as a banner ad. Because if it gets to that point where it truly doesn't matter where it lives and you're just putting an article with different headlines over it in different publications, then it's not native at all. You've just, I mean, you've just tried to invent advertorials, which definitely already exist. You just buy the page and you happen to put words on it. And you can certainly do that. There's value in that. If you truly want scale and you just want a chance to say something in your own voice, then maybe advertorial is the way to go. Buy the page, put the words on it instead of the picture. But if you want to create storytelling and you want it to be native, then it has to be on some level custom. That's just the name of the game. You know, and it's so easy for us to think about this in other parts of our life, right? If you were dating, you were in the dating world, you're trying to find the love of your life, and you took every single person, regardless of their interests or how you met, on the exact same first date, how likely is it that that person would feel heard, would feel like they had a special connection with you? They wouldn't. They would feel like they were on a conveyor belt and you were just feeding them the same lines you feed everyone else. And that's how your customers are going to feel too. If you're putting out custom content that listens to them, that acknowledges their questions, that says, hey, I know you like these things, so I'm giving you these things, right? Instead of just, hey, all of you are humans, so I'm giving you this one same experience and hoping that it has the desired impact. You know, I think that that customization, while it does add some challenges of scale, it adds a depth that you can't achieve if you're purely, you know, on a conveyor belt format.
And I love the fact that you just added dating advice to our podcast. I didn't see that coming. That's awesome.
Yeah. Now you can tag it in two categories, right?
Exactly. So before I let you go, I just want to know a little bit, you know, what's going on in your life right now? Are you working on some exciting projects?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my world, when I'm not hanging out with you guys or coming to Native Ad Days, mostly what I do is consult with brands and publishers on how to tell better brand stories. So I'm working with a number of different publishers right now, kind of doing things like sales training, you know, retraining their sales team on how to speak the language of content, if that's something they're not familiar with. I'm working with some brands as well who are trying to adopt that sort of journalistic publisher mindset on their own content teams, right? What can they learn from the publishing side? So I'm working with a couple different brands here on everything from doing competitive reports to, you know, retraining their content teams on how to think more like journalists. And I'm doing a ton of speaking too. It's been a really awesome year for me getting to do some international travel. I got to come out and see you guys out in Copenhagen. So it's definitely been a lot of fun kind of taking that, taking the story fuel message and taking the message of better brand stories around the world.
And if people want to learn more from you, I know you put out a great newsletter. Could you tell us, like, where could the audience find that newsletter?
So right now, what I'd actually love to point people to is I actually put together a free story idea guide. So I think I assume if the folks are listening to this, that this will be super, super helpful for them. You know, it's kind of a 13, 14 page workbook style guide that's going to walk you through that ideation process that we were talking about. How do you come up with these unique content ideas that are really going to provide value to your audience? So you can find that at storyfuel.co/idea guide. And I'm sure we'll have a link for you in your show notes, but storyfuel.co/idea guide, that will get you added to the email list, but it also allows me to send you that first confirmation email with a link to download the story idea guide so you can take your brainstorming for content ideas to the next level.
Awesome. I'm going to go download that right now. So thank you so much for being on the show, Melanie, and I hope to see you soon.
Sounds good. Talk to you soon.
And for you guys listening to the show, before you go download Melanie's awesome guide, don't forget to drop us a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. And while you're there, make sure to subscribe. You can also be notified each time we launch a new episode by signing up for our podcast newsletter at nativeadvertisinginstitute.com/podcast. And finally, if you want to learn more, please join us in Berlin for Native Advertising Days, November 6th through 8th. Visit nativeadvertisinginstitute.com/days for more information. That's all for now, folks. Next week, I'm very proud to welcome the head of Native Advertising at SAP, Tim Clark, on the show. He's running one of the most consistent and successful Native Advertising programs on Forbes.com. So make sure to be back for more advice on how to build your own native advertising powerhouse.
That's it, you guys. Remember to subscribe to the Native Advertising Powerhouse podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud.